Okay, welcome everyone. My name is Logan Brocard. I'm a senior health promotion specialist at PTCC, and I'm moderating today's webinar, Menthol and Flavor Ban Evaluation Results. For those of you who are logged into our webinar, you'll see the presentation on your right. On the left-hand side of the screen, you'll see a chat box. We've set aside time for questions throughout the presentation, but at any time during the presentation, feel free to enter any question into the box, and we'll address them as we can. We may not answer the questions in order, but we'll do our best to answer each question at the appropriate time. Before we begin, we'd like to get a better sense of how many have joined us today. So please indicate how many are attending today's webinar with you by clicking on the circle beside the appropriate number. Okay, thanks everyone. I'd like to introduce today's speakers, Dr. Rob Schwartz, Mr. Robert Nugent, and Dr. Michael Chaitin. I'm going to introduce all three at the same time, make it easier for us and to give us a bit more time for the presentation. So Rob Schwartz is the Executive Director of OTRU and Professor at the Dalhousie School of Public Health at the University of Toronto with interests in research, evaluation, and knowledge exchange. Robert Nugent is the Manager, Business Intelligence Division, Tobacco Control Directorate at Health Canada. Robert has more than 20 years of experience as a Senior Policy Analyst and Manager of Research at Health Canada in the areas of infectious diseases and tobacco control. In his current position since 2007, he has been responsible for the management and analysis of tobacco market data collected under federal regulations from the tobacco industry. His current research activities are focused on the development of partnerships between Health Canada's Tobacco Control Directorate and Canadian academics involved in tobacco control. Our final speaker today is Michael Chaitin. Michael is a scientist at the Ontario Tobacco Research Unit and assistant professor at the Dalhousie School of Public Health at the University of Toronto. His work involves understanding the impact of policy on smoking cessation and the development of tobacco-related comorbidities, and he is the co-instructor of the graduate-level course Tobacco and Health, From Cells to Society. Robert Schwartz.
Okay, thank you. Welcome, everybody. A pleasure to be with you once again and to speak with you about the questions of banning flavors and including menthol in that ban in Ontario since 2016. So, I mean, when you look at the title of the overall webinar, which is Evaluation Results for the Menthol and Flavor Bans, I mean, it doesn't sound so terribly exciting, and one might think that it's pretty straightforward. The government decided to ban them. There's a law. You're not allowed to sell these things. So likely there's no sales or very few sales, and the bans will have achieved their objectives. Well, there may be a few surprises for you in this presentation, so hold tight in your seats. So, first of all, when we go to evaluate these policies, we want to know why, what was the purpose, what are we trying to achieve? The slide that's in front of you tells you why we think in tobacco control that it's a good idea to ban flavored tobacco, including menthol tobacco. Reasons are listed on the slide. So we know that from survey data that the proportion of youth who smoke, who used menthol cigarettes, for example, was very high. We also know that tobacco flavors in all kinds of candy and fruit, in cigarillos, small cigars, and in smokeless tobacco were very attractive to kids. These were considered, all of them, including the menthol cigarettes, gateways into regular long-term tobacco use. Menthol in particular is considered to make the cigarette less harsh. It's got a better aroma, better aftertaste. There are perceptions amongst smokers that it's healthier, though that's certainly not true. Because of these things, people who are already smoking may find it harder to decrease the number of cigarettes that they smoke, and certainly harder to quit. All of this is not from the top of my head. It's well documented in research, and in particular in the FDA papers that they published a couple of years ago on menthol. In 2016, Ontario decided to ban flavors, almost all flavors, in cigars, smokeless tobacco, and shisha, with the exceptions of alcohol-based and menthol-flavored cigars, and cigars that weigh more than, it should say, more than 6 grams. In 2017, menthol was added to that, so that since January 1st, 2017, you're not allowed to have menthol in cigarettes or in other tobacco products. Well, what do we hope to accomplish? This is a very simplified theory of change, that by banning menthol, the cigarettes and other tobacco products will be less appealing, in particular for youngsters. They will be less satisfying for those who try them and those who have been using. Therefore, since menthol will no longer be available, there will be an increase in the number of people who successfully quit smoking, a decrease in consumption for those smokers of menthol who don't succeed in quitting altogether, and a decrease in initiation. So that is pretty straightforward, and what we're going to do today is we're going to show you what, first of all, I'm going to talk about what the industry did to prevent this from happening, and we'll then provide some data to show to what extent they succeeded in their efforts to sort of deflect the potential bad consequences of the bans on menthol and flavored cigarettes for their sales. So we're just going to go to studying industry tactics. So this is a small study that we did. The study was funded through the NIH in the United States, probably because the United States is still considering, or has been considering, one might say, a ban on menthol and on flavored tobacco there. So we went to eight convenience stores in different neighborhoods in Toronto, somewhat randomly chosen. We purchased from them 30 packs of menthol. This is pre-ban, so we did this a couple of months before the menthol ban went into effect. And then we did a content analysis, that's that guy with the magnifying glass, to see what did these packs look like? What was the industry trying to convey in these packs? Well, some interesting findings, which are summarized here and then a bit of detail in the coming slides. 14 out of the 30 menthol packs available pre-ban were capsule packs. I'll talk about that in a minute. The packs altogether, the 30, came in different colors. Green has traditionally been the color associated with menthol, but we also found packs that were blue and silver, particularly the capsule packs, and some white ones as well. Thirdly, we found that on the packs themselves, there was already pre-ban wording telling the smokers, well, once the ban comes into effect, here's what you should try to replace this menthol pack. Here's what will have the same kind of smooth taste as your menthol cigarette. So that's three. And four, these are the kinds of words that we have that are in the wording on the menthol packs. All kinds of things associated with choice, smoothness, freshness, refreshing taste, and crispness. So that's what we found ahead of time. Here you can see an example of a pack saying what your new smooth-tasting non-menthol alternative will be once the ban comes into effect. And in the next slide, you can see what's happening with capsules. So interestingly, there were no capsule cigarettes being sold in Ontario prior to the announcement of the ban. Then they came in such that almost half of the menthol packs available were actually available in capsules. The crushable capsule it goes into the filter and it allows the smoker to bite down on it, to crush it at any point they want during their smoking experience in order to provide the menthol taste. The wording, as I said before, is focusing on choice. There's also a power button there. The power button, we think, reflects a message that people have the choice. You know, their power is theirs to turn on the menthol taste or turn off the menthol taste. Why capsules? It may be that the industry was trying to get people used to the idea of smoking parts of cigarettes without having the menthol taste in them. It may be that they were trying to get people used to the idea that there are technologies coming forward that will replace menthol, and we'll see that in the post-ban. They were, you know, heavily pushed, the capsules on the price signs and in other ways. And then Michael's going to tell you a little bit about our second study, which was a survey, where we found that in the short period of time during which capsules were available in Ontario, they actually became quite popular. So about 20% of the smokers were regularly using capsules by the time of the ban. Finally here, you can see the wording on the bottom, to choose your intensity, your taste intensity. It's your choice. Just crush that that capsule. So that is a synopsis of what the industry did prior to the ban in order to prepare smokers. And I just did something bad so that I can't. There we go. And then we wanted to find out, well, what happened post-ban? So the ban, as I said, came to effect January 1st, 2017. We went out into the fields several weeks later. We went to 5 convenience stores this time, and we were able to purchase 23 replacement packs. Again, we did content analysis. And finally, we had the advantage of looking at the Tobacco Information System, TIS, where we found lots of information about what inspectors were finding relevant to the finding of menthol and flavors in the field. And here are the key findings of what we found when we looked at the PACS post-ban. There were lots of materials. So there was a wheel, there were pamphlets, brochures, available certainly to the vendors, as it turns out, partially also available to customers, which lined up. Well, here's what you were smoking, the menthol you were smoking before. Here's what you should choose as your menthol alternative pack. Two, the technological changes, which we think may, the capsules may have been a precursor to these. For the first time, we see an aqua filter. That's a capsule full of water that's put in the filter. What's that about? We see adjustable filters. Twist the filter to adjust how much resistance there is in it. And we see charcoal filter cigarettes. All of these were new. We didn't see them prior to the ban. The replacement packs were designed largely to look a lot like the menthol packs that they were replacing in color. Still had the capsule pack symbols, the power buttons, and the same kind of descriptors, smooth and fresh tasting. So clearly the industry was doing as much as it could to keep the smokers using regular cigarettes, which were no longer truly menthol cigarettes, but they're trying to convey to the smoker, well, these are, as if they were menthol cigarettes, so don't stop smoking, don't cut down on your smoking, keep on smoking, and here's what you should be using. Here's an example of a green replacement pack, and here's an example of how the industry placed the prior menthol pack in a pamphlet, and showed you, well, which of the ones afterwards are going to be your menthol replacements. And here's an example of the adjustable filter. drawn player choice with a new adjustable filter has replaced drawn player charge. You know, so note the word choice now, clearly replacing a previous menthol pack. There's no mistaking what the industry tactics were as they try to prevent what tobacco control advocates hoped that the ban would bring about, which is less initiation, more consumption, and less consumption and more cessation. Finally, there is some anecdotal evidence of some shenanigans, things happening that shouldn't have happened. So anecdotally, we've heard about vendors being pressured and offered incentives to push menthol replacement packs. That's not allowed. There were some posters and stickers that people have seen in stores indicating which of the packs the menthol smoker should choose for replacing their menthol cigarettes. Finally, there were some visible notices of that the menthol cigarettes are being banned, and telling the customers, just ask your vendor what you should take as a replacement. Again, certainly not in the spirit of the law and maybe in direct contravention to the regulations. To wrap up this section of the presentation, we see that the industry was quite active, you know, within the confines of a dark market in pushing smokers to replacement menthol packs and doing their best to prevent more smokers from stopping to smoke, from cutting down, and from getting less youth to initiate. So we're going to pause there for any questions and answers until now.
So we have one question in the chat box. Rob, is there any data to confirm if sales for these types of cigarettes increased over the past year, or is this not attainable by the tobacco companies?
There is data. We're actually going to get to that.
Okay. And there's a second question. Did you also see the emergence of new products like IPSA cards that could be used with packs to flavor tobacco?
Yeah. So we've seen some of that happening. We don't know to what extent that's happening around the province, but certainly we have seen examples of that.
Okay. Maybe let's move on to Robert, and if people have questions, please continue to put them in the chat box.
Okay. So, Rob Nugent here. I'm very pleased to be part of this discussion today on the impacts of measures to regulate flavored tobacco products in Canada. I think, you know, we all know that these measures at both the federal and provincial level have been very important public health interventions to principally protect youth from inducements to tobacco use. And today, Dr. Schwartz and Dr. Chaitin are presenting new research that's been done to measure the impacts of flavored tobacco regulations on the markets for cigarettes, cigars, and smokeless tobacco. I would say that, you know, I think that this is really important work, not just for us in Canada to understand the impacts of these regulations, but, you know, at Health Canada, at the national level here. This is important work for other countries that might be designing and implementing flavor bans to be able to learn from the Canadian experience. With my brief presentation this afternoon, what I hope to add here is that I'd like to set out a little bit of the national and historical context for flavored tobacco sales in Canada. And hopefully the presentation that I'm about to give here will help us understand a bit some of the flavored tobacco product trends that have been drivers for the flavor regulations that we're discussing today. So what I'm going to do in the next few minutes then is provide an assessment of the national sales trends for key flavored tobacco product categories in Canada with a focus on, like my collaborators' presentations here today, menthol cigarettes, cigars, and smokeless tobacco. I should say something about the data set that I'll be using today. This data, all the data in my presentation is taken from tobacco industry sales reports submitted to Health Canada under the Tobacco Reporting Regulations, Section 13. For not everyone would be familiar with this data set. The Tobacco Reporting Regulations are federal regulations that require tobacco companies to report information related to tobacco products sold in Canada. And so they report information federally on ingredients in tobacco products, emissions, research, and also sales data. And that's what we'll be focused on today. So what we're looking at here is the history of menthol cigarette sales in Canada since 2001. And in 2016, you can see there that tobacco companies sold a little more than 1.5 billion menthol cigarettes in Canada. That was more menthol cigarettes sold than at any point since 2001. Now, let's think about that for a second. This is remarkable because all cigarettes, sales of all cigarettes actually declined by 33% between 2001 and 2016. In 2001, we sold about 42 billion cigarettes in Canada nationally, and in 2016, only 29 billion units. So what this tells us is that menthol cigarette sales have been very resilient in the face of declines in smoking prevalence, and in the face of declines in overall cigarette sales. When you look at the 2016 number, 1.5 billion, this shows us that tobacco company shipments of menthol cigarettes increased by almost 19% in 2016 over the previous year. In 2016, these shipments were the largest year-over-year increase for menthol cigarettes that we ever recorded under the Tobacco Reporting Regulations. So menthol is going out with a bang in Canada and not with a whimper. What's even more remarkable about this significant increase in menthol cigarette sales in 2016 is that this occurred despite the fact that there were bans for the full year on menthol in three provinces. Alberta, Nova Scotia, and New Brunswick had menthol bans for the entire year. And Quebec had a menthol ban that came into place in August of 2016. So this raises the question, with those bans and with an impending ban in Canada's largest province, Ontario, what happened here? Why did menthol cigarette sales increase so much in 2016? Before I answer that question, or try to, I just want to illustrate in another way just how odd the 2016 shipment levels of menthol products actually were. In 2016, menthol cigarettes in Canada, shipments of them, accounted for 5.4% of all cigarettes shipped in Canada. And that was the highest level ever reported under the Tobacco Reporting Regulations. As we can see from this slide, menthol cigarettes were always somewhere between 4 and 5% of the cigarette market since 2001. But in 2016, we hit a 16-year high for menthol cigarettes as a total percentage of the cigarette market. So, you know, something else to mention here, I guess, is that while the national level of menthol was always at about 4 or 5% of all cigarette sales, there was never any provinces that deviated much from that. In other words, all provinces had a traditional menthol percentage of somewhere between 3 and 7%. No province had a menthol market that was in the double digits in terms of percentage of cigarettes sold. But this changed in 2016. And this is, I guess, what we could call the last gasp of menthol cigarettes in Canada. As we can see, menthol cigarettes were disappearing or had disappeared in those provinces that instituted bans prior to or during 2016. If you were a province that didn't have a menthol ban, your shipments rose to significantly higher levels than traditional levels of menthol market share. And so the question becomes, why did we see these increased menthol shipments? There's a few possible explanations. Some of them, I think, better than others. One potential explanation is that and this would be a fairly innocent one, is that maybe companies were clearing inventories. Maybe in advance of bans on menthol, they were shipping more menthol products to allow smokers to stock up prior to the ban. I'm not so sure that that was the case. Another possible explanation is that tobacco companies were creating opportunities for cross-border shopping. So, for example, if you have a menthol ban in Alberta, maybe you ship more menthol products to BC. I don't know if there's any evidence for that yet. We may see some in the future, but I think the best explanation for this is related to the presentation that Dr. Schwartz just gave. The principal driver was that these increased menthol shipments were linked to product innovations and product launches, specifically these capsule products, which appear to have been used by tobacco companies in an effort to migrate menthol smokers to non-menthol brands. And certainly when you look at the microdata reported by the companies, this does appear to be the key driver for increased shipments of menthol. So this is my last slide on menthol, just to make this point about how odd 2016 was. Menthol shipments in 2016 were very abnormal. They represented a significant shift in tobacco company strategies related to menthol in advance of federal and provincial regulation. A number of provinces here saw 50% to 60% more menthol products shipped, and some provinces saw double the amount of menthol that would normally be shipped. Again, the tobacco companies here seeming to have menthol go out with a bang rather than a whimper. I will note, finally here, that next month there's a federal ban on menthol that comes into effect for cigarettes, blunt wraps, and cigars that weigh less than 6 grams or have a filter or non-spiral wrap. So at the federal level, we've announced and will soon be implementing our plan for a national menthol ban. Cigars. Cigars are also traditionally a very heavily flavored product category in Canada. And this slide shows cigar sales in Canada from 2001 to 2016. Now, in 2016, there were 354 million cigars reported sold in Canada. To put that into perspective, in a cigarette, you know, the cigarette market is about 28.5 billion cigarettes. So for every one cigar that gets smoked in Canada, Canadians smoke about 80 cigarettes. So when we look at this history of cigar sales since 2001, there are two major swings in the market. First, we see the cigar market triple in size from 2001 to its peak in 2009. It peaks at 650 million cigars sold. That increase was driven by new cigar products at the time, which were small, filtered cigars. And these cigars were heavily flavored with fruit flavors and confectionery flavors. That growth in the cigar market is a remarkable increase when you consider that it occurred during a time when smoking prevalence and cigarette sales were significantly declining in Canada. And so this was a tobacco product trend that went against the grain of our broader smoking trends. At the time, it was easy to see some research came along that showed that those new products were appealing to youth. And that led to the first wave of federal flavor regulation in Canada. In 2009, there was an amendment to the Tobacco Act that banned certain additives and flavors, with the exception of menthol, in cigarettes, little cigars, and blunt wraps. And after that regulation, after 2009, you can see, I will observe here, that in the 2 years following that amendment to the Federal Tobacco Act, cigar sales declined by about 30%. Following that decline, you can see a period of stability there between 2011 and 2014, where sales are relatively flat. And then again in 2015 and 2016, we once again begin to see declines in the cigar market that I would observe appear to generally coincide with new federal and provincial restrictions on flavors and cigars. Dr. Chaitin is going to have more to say about these changes in the cigar market over time and the extent to which federal and provincial flavor regulations can be said to have played a role in them. Smokeless tobacco. So smokeless tobacco is another tobacco product category where flavors play a very important role, either as core ingredients or as characterizing flavors that play an explicit role in the marketing of the product. This has increasingly made smokeless tobacco a target for regulation at the provincial level. I'll say a few things about this product. It's a niche tobacco product in the sense that it's used, if you look at population surveys, by around 1% of the population. It's used almost exclusively by men in Canada. There are also some large differences in provincial consumption in Canada. So, for example, 75% of all sales of smokeless tobacco occur west of Ontario in Canada, and 40% of national consumption occurs in Alberta alone. So it's very much a Western Canadian phenomena. Having said that, despite the fact that so few people use this product in Canada, if you look at the sales trend here, this is a surprisingly resilient product. In 2016, we had more smokeless tobacco consumed in Canada than in 2002. Between 2003 and 2012, when you look at this slide, you can see that sales of smokeless tobacco increased in 8 of 9 years during that period. Only beginning in 2013 did we see a trend toward declining sales. And now, finally, in the last 4 years, we have 4 consecutive years of sales declines. Sales were at 294,000 kilograms of smokeless tobacco nationally in 2016. Now, as we know, some provinces have recently begun to regulate flavors in smokeless tobacco. And Dr. Chaitin in his presentation will have more to say about how smokeless tobacco sales trends have been impacted by those provincial interventions. So I'll conclude with this. We saw that menthol cigarette sales increased by almost 19% in 2016 and reached their highest level since 2002, even though 4 provinces had implemented bans. And I've speculated a bit today about what's been driving that trend, and I think Dr. Schwartz's presentation gave us some good insight into why tobacco companies were shipping significantly more menthol in 2016. With respect to cigars, cigars sales declined in 2016 by 5.4%, and that was the 7th consecutive year of declining sales. The one difference with cigars versus menthol and smokeless tobacco is that there are now a couple of waves of regulation that have affected cigars. So we've been regulating additives and flavors in cigars since 2009. Menthol and smokeless tobacco, which seem to have be more resilient sales-wise, we've only recently begun to regulate those products. And finally, smokeless tobacco. It's a heavily flavored product category with a very resilient market in Canada. We seem finally to have sales going in the right direction in terms of declines. But this product has only recently become the target of flavor regulations at the provincial level. And as I said, Dr. Chaitin will have more to say about how those regulations might be impacting the market. I'll stop there. And just thanks for letting me share what federally reported tobacco industry data is telling us about the evolution of the flavored tobacco market in Canada. One quick shout-out to my colleague Gabrielle Tremblay, who does some amazing work analyzing data here at Health Canada and whose fingerprints are all very much on the presentation that I just gave today.
Thanks, Robert. We have a number of questions for you in the chat. So the first one is this being shipped to be sold, delivered, or actually sold sales at the retail level?
Okay. So these, the data that I've just presented, these are shipments from that go directly from tobacco companies, some directly to retailers, some to wholesalers, depending on the province. Virtually all the tobacco companies now have a direct-to-retail model. So these are shipments that go from the companies to retailers, the vast majority of them. But depending sometimes in more rural areas or in smaller provinces, these are shipments that go from the companies to wholesalers. And then, of course, from wholesalers to retailers.
So the second question is, can you elaborate on the national menthol ban you plan to introduce? Could you remind us what products this will affect? You mentioned papers and smaller cigarettes.
Right. So the core of the menthol ban is on products that are already under federal regulation. So it's menthol in October is being banned in cigarettes, cigars. That are under 6 grams have tipping paper, have a filter or a non-spiral wrap, and also in blunt wraps. It does not apply to smokeless tobacco, for example.
And there's a follow-up question. Will the ban extend to e-cigarette flavors? If not, how do you expect the availability of this flavored product will impact the market?
Yes. The legislation and regulations related to vaping products is still under development. So unfortunately, I'm not in a position to say anything about what Parliament will decide with respect to those measures.
And the final question for you is, are the sales of these products inclusive of First Nations reserves?
If First Nations producers are under federal regulation and are paying federal excise duty on their products, there are First Nations producers that report under the tobacco reporting regulations. I can't guarantee that all federally taxed tobacco products on reserve are reported.
Okay. Thanks, Robert. I see that there are a number of questions for Dr. Swartz. I think I'm going to leave them until after Dr. Chaitin's presentation. So, Michael, to unmute your line, it's *7. Michael?
Hi,
yes.
Green. Can you hear me? Okay,
we
great.
We can hear you.
Excellent. Thank you.
Thank you.
So, hello, and thank you for listening to us so far. And my job here today is really to muddy the waters a little bit on the back of Rob's excellent presentation and clear description of sales of menthol and flavored products in Canada. And what I'm looking to do here is to present a bit on some of the research that we did to see if we can associate those sales with what kind of impact they would have, what kind of impact the regulations had on sales, and if we could attribute any of those changes directly to those regulations themselves. We used the same data set, the reported net sales, although Rob used presented data by yearly, we used data by quarterly as it's reported. Identified the flavor descriptors of the flavored products of smokeless and cigars. It's important to note here that what we are talking about is not flavored per se. So we didn't look at whether the additives in the tobacco, we looked at whether or not they identified themselves as a flavored product, which is consistent with the way, at least in Ontario, the way these products have been regulated, although not hopefully under the federal regulations. Then we used a technique called segmented regression to identify the changes in the intercept and the slope of trends that were associated with the regulations. We put in a variable at the point in time of each of the where the regulations came in and looked to see if there was a break in this trend associated with the timing of the intervention. And we could use this to see if this change over time was actually statistically significant given the underlying trends that were previously observed. So for cigar sales, and here's, or just we'll use this as an example of, we use the same model for cigars and smokeless. And we can see that we divided this into a number of different sections. So this is the cigar unit sales in millions. The dots represent sales by quarter in Ontario. The little diamonds represent sales by quarter in BC. And we've used these two provinces as controls so that we would expect that changes that would happen in Ontario due to federal regulations to also happen in BC. And if they diverged when they wouldn't be expected to, we would be an evidence, the suggestion that it wasn't the regulations that were having the effect. On the other side, where the province's sales diverged and the regulation diverged too, for instance, in 2016, which are the Ontario regulations covered smokeless tobacco products, but not there were no such regulations in BC, that would be evidence that the flavor, it was in fact the regulations that were impacting sales. So in terms of cigar sales, we can see that the 2010 ban happened at this peak of the increase in sales of cigars, and that this time period, the 2009 to 2010, or January 1st, 2010, when we could first start seeing the post-implementation sales data come in, was associated with a big drop in sales of cigars, both flavored and unflavored. And we can see as well is that that trend line shifted downwards after those implementation of the regulations in both Ontario and BC in the red below. However, when we come to 2016, we see much smaller change. And that, in fact, is not statistically significant once we take into consideration the trend. We see a small drop, a non-significant drop in Ontario, and no apparent drop in BC. And again, this change appears to be not significant associated with the 2016 regulations. When we break this down for cigar sales by flavored descriptors and non-flavored descriptors, we can see a little bit more how the mechanism of these regulations, and that we can see a big drop in sales associated with the 2010 regulations. In Ontario, that this drop is about a 26% decrease, and that's not a raw sales. This is the decrease that was associated with the change in the ban itself. There was, again, a small drop in 2016, a model decrease of 12% in Ontario, although that was not statistically significant. This larger drop in 2010 associated with the change in regulations, again, as evidence suggests that because these are the types of products we would expect to have a demonstrated change, that this is likely a result of those regulations. In contrast, the unflavored unit sales of cigars showed little changes in 2010, where there was a small but insignificant increase in associated with the 2010 ban in both Ontario and BC, and no change of unflavored unit sales in 2016, according to the model data. Again, the model rather than the real actual data sales. For smokeless sales, we see a different pattern. So this is overall smokeless sales, including both flavored and unflavored units. And what we see here is that in 2010, we actually noted an increase in smokeless sales in both Ontario and BC. Although there were no regulations affecting smokeless sales at either the federal or provincial level at this time. There are a number of potential explanations for it, including potentially the possibility that there was a product substitution. But I think we need to look further at that before making conclusive statements about that. In 2016, however, we see a clear indication of the impact of the Ontario regulations on smokeless tobacco. We see this blue line here represents the change in the decrease in smokeless tobacco use in Ontario from this point down to this line here, associated with the implementation of the 2016 Ontario regulations. In contrast, smokeless tobacco use, the model showed that the 2016 actually had it going up in BC, although that was not significant. When we break smokeless sales down by flavor descriptors and non-flavor descriptors, we see even more dramatically the impact of the Ontario regulations, and that after 2016, this large decrease, almost all of smokeless tobacco with flavor descriptors, a 98% decrease, likely that to be even continued further in 2016 associated with those flavor descriptors. So they basically have removed them from the market. In 2010, we note a small increase in flavored sales associated with that time period of the ban. Unflavored smokeless sales. It's important to note that in 2010, we also saw an increase in unflavored descriptor smokeless sales in Ontario and BC, and which would, again, is a sort of a strike against the idea that this was that increase was associated with the product substitution. It might have been something else. I just also want to note that right now I'm showing you the sort of the simple modeled linear trends. We looked at this in a couple of different ways, some sensitivity analysis on looking at the trends to see if that affected our interpretation of the statistical significance. Adding more variables and being making the lines more complicated certainly made the model fit better, but it didn't actually change any of our interpretation. And we can see, though, in 2016 in Ontario that there was, I think, some clear evidence of substitution as unflavored descriptor smokeless sales increased quite dramatically to compensate for the disappearance of flavored smokeless products from the province. We can also look a little bit further at the details of the changes in those flavor descriptors themselves. So this is sales of cigars in Ontario, as an example, and looking at alcohol and fruit flavor descriptors, again, not flavors themselves, but descriptors. And this dotted line here shows the trends in sales, this increase in cigar sales that we've seen before, I think largely associated with this fruit-flavored trend, and then the decrease around the time of the 2009-2010 regulations. And then finally in 2016, as those fruit flavors are banned from most types of cigars and tobacco products, that those almost disappear entirely. In contrast, alcohol flavors were selling at very low levels before 2010, and it was only relatively shortly before 2010 that we started to see significant sales of cigar products that did have these alcohol descriptors. But they came on very strongly again around this time of the 2009-2010 regulations. And we see that in 2016, as the fruit flavors fall off the market, that some of this appears to have been that alcohol flavor descriptor products seem to have taken some of their place. Beyond alcohol and fruit, there are a number of different other flavors. We see in Ontario, again, this green line here is products with no flavor descriptors at all or unclear flavor descriptors. And we could see a general trend through most of the time of we see a decrease actually associated with 2009 regulations in those with no descriptors and a slight increase in 2016 of cigars with no clear descriptors. Also interesting was that around the 2009 regulations, we see the emergence of products that use a color descriptor, things like red or blue or yellow, and those color descriptor flavors really increased dramatically around that in 2009, and are consistently strong in the market in Ontario. However, in 2016, those sales start to decline. Those products are actually, many of them were relabeled, and many of them were moved from flavored, from colored labels to actually alcohol labels as well. The other thing to note, it's hard to see on the scale, but what happened in the 2010 period was the emergence of the mentholated cigars as a class. This is a very light blue line you can't see here. And sales increased from a relatively low level, but quite to a significant one by into 2016. Finally, we look at smokeless flavors in Ontario and some of the other descriptors. And we see that that the main story here is that for menthol and other flavors in smokeless, they actually see that this line here is fruit and this line is mint and menthol, and those actually left the market before they were required to. Generally, particularly, we can see that the mint menthol was well in advance of the regulations that required them to change. In compensation, of course, we can see that smokeless tobaccos with no descriptor labels increased over 2016. In BC, I'll just go through very quickly, it's generally the same story about changes in the descriptors in BC as it is in Ontario for both fruits and alcohol, no descriptors. And menthol products and colored products. Obviously, there were different sales for fruit flavors, which, unlike in Ontario, where fruit flavors were banned, sales of fruit appeared to continue going up in smokeless in BC. So in conclusion of the analysis of this data, flavor regulations have had a significant impact on sales of cigars, particularly in the first set of regulations in 2010, which had a major impact on the trends of sales and smokeless products, particularly in 2016 in Ontario. The sales data do give some indication of adaptation. For instance, the emergence of menthol cigars, a category that had not existed previously, and the emergence of alcohol flavors, colored, and the switch back and forth between alcohol, fruit flavors, and color descriptors on the labels. This concludes this first part of my presentation, and I just have one more piece to go through, talking about... maybe I'll answer a few questions about about that Health Canada data. Um, Should I stop here, Graham?
If you want to take the question now, you can. Someone's asking about other provinces. Do you have any data on that?
We do. We've looked at those a bit. And again, Rob Nugent showed the overall sales trends and looking at 2015-16 sales. So we haven't gone in depth, and we haven't done the modeling analysis work that we have for Ontario versus BC. We would expect certainly that the effect in 2010 is probably consistent, and we'd have to see about whether or not 2016, if we included all of the provinces.
And then there's another question. Was there a drop in total smokeless tobacco sales in Ontario after the 2016 ban?
Yes, there was a significant drop in total smokeless sales in Ontario. So there was an elimination of the flavored tobacco market, and then some compensation, an increase in the unflavored tobacco market, but not enough to override that change.
So far that's all the questions, Michael, if you want to carry on.
Sure. So now I'm going to move on to talk a little bit about from sales data to human data, human smoking behavior change, looking at, instead of flavored tobacco flavored cigars and smokeless, looking at cigarettes and the effect of the menthol ban in Ontario. I just want to acknowledge that this part of the study, as Rob Schwartz said earlier, was funded by the NIH through P50 to Tom Eisenberg. And our collaborators, John Cohen, Eric Sol. And this study had a number of different components, but the primary one was we're following menthol smokers from before to after the ban. We initially did a random digit dial sample of any smokers in Ontario, and we gathered about 1,000 smokers. And then we, including all Ontario residents age 16 plus who are current smokers. And there were about 300 menthol smokers in that sample. And to that group, we recruited another 700 menthol smokers from our longitudinal panel for smokers panels for the longitudinal follow-up. We then followed them up about a month after the ban, starting in February 2017. And again, as Rob said, the before and after purchase study was also funded through this grant. The characteristics of menthol smokers in Ontario, according to our random sample, were about 27% had smoked a menthol cigarette in the past year. And of these, about 48% of the past year menthol smokers were using menthol regularly, or that they were primary menthol smokers. Menthol smokers were slightly different than the other smokers. They were a bit younger and a bit less likely to be white, but importantly, that menthol smokers in Ontario were overwhelmingly still white compared to the demographics you might see in the U.S. and other countries. There were no other significant demographic or smoking characteristic differences, either by education, cigarette smoke by being per day or being a non-daily smoker. They were, however, more likely to use other types of flavored and unflavored tobacco, like e-cigarettes, cigars, and so on. One of the interesting things that we found was that awareness of the ban was very low prior to the implementation of the ban on menthol. So when we called people from 3 to 1 month, or even a couple of weeks before the ban had come in, only 40% of menthol users and 25% of non-menthol users had either heard of the law. And there were concerns that something like this is a big deal internationally, and that we would have expected to see. We thought we might see a political backlash, news stories, smokers being upset, but in fact, it was very quiet, and so quiet that many even of the menthol users didn't know that it was about to come. This slide, I think, is this, or probably the key one here, and it takes a look at the predicted behavior versus the actual behavior and the then predicted behavior of from the after the ban was implemented, so what people are planning to do long term. And what we found is that what people said that they were going to do when the ban came in versus what they actually did did not match up particularly well. Correlation between those was extraordinarily low. We found that those who didn't know what they were going to do was 16% before the implementation of the ban. And then after the implementation of the ban, 16% still didn't know what they were going to do long-term in the future. There were a small number of people who thought that they might add menthol or have some other adaptation to get around the law. And a number of people did actually use these things like the ITSA cards that were mentioned earlier or flavor drops, but only 3% of our sample. And in fact, nobody said that they were going to use these long term. There was about 16% said that they would use contraband menthol sources. 12% actually purchased contraband menthol. That is, it's not necessarily, I'm not counting menthol here for that was purchased from a store, but that was sought out from other means, like from online or at a known contraband source. And a relatively similar number thought they would use that contraband menthol in the future. 10% believed that they were going to use a flavored product to substitute for the menthol, like a e-cigarette or a flavored cigar or other type of tobacco product. And it turned out that a huge number of people, a large number of people anyway, 34%, had actually tried or used some sort of flavored product in the time since the flavor ban. Not all of these people, of course, were using it as specifically to substitute, but just who had used a flavored product. However, it's important to note that, again, that the predicting going forward, long-term reliance on these alternative sources of flavors, it was a significant change from before. It goes from 10% to 5%, that fewer people thought that these would be a way of adapting to the law. One way in people it significantly increased the way they thought they would adapt to the law was through quitting. So this is the good news of this law. That before it was implemented, 10% thought that they were going to quit or try to quit because of the law. 40% actually made a quit attempt, and 20% were then thought that they were going to continue to try and adapt to this law by quitting smoking for good. About half of smokers before the law came in said that they would just switch to using non-menthol cigarettes only. And that was consistent with the number who thought they would use long-term. But it's important to note that this may be reflective of what people think they're doing in terms of adaptation. When we count the number of people who used menthol cigarettes only but did not try and quit, did not use a contraband product, did not use any other flavored product, there was only 24% of smokers in this long-term sample who were exclusive exclusively adapted by using non-menthol cigarettes.
Michael, before you go to the next slide, there's a question there about quit. And when you spoke, you talked about quit attempts versus actual quits. Can you maybe just clarify that?
Sure. I have a slide on quitting in a second. So we're going a little bit deeper into the actual behavior here. So smoker response at 1 month post-ban. So these are what smokers did. 34% had smoked menthol post the ban at some point. This level was higher, of course, among people who were primary or regular menthol smokers. compared to those who use menthol only occasionally. 25% of our longitudinal sample had tried to obtain menthol at some point, and of those, 13% of those were unsuccessful at obtaining. Among this 25%, there were various methods where they were successful. So a couple, a very small amount, sought menthol cigarettes online or duty-free or in another country. A few sought from friends. 34% were still able to purchase menthol from our stores. And this is a real indication of how early our and short-term our evaluation was. As when we did our pack purchase study, we were not able to purchase any menthol tobacco. And certainly anecdotally and from we'll know the sales of menthol tobacco at stores really plummeted after at least a month after the implementation of the law. So these are still people who have carried over or had stocked up or who had been able to purchase in the early days of after the implementation. 36% of those who obtained, who had tried to obtain menthol cigarettes had done so out of a First Nations reserve. It's important to note that this is the 36% of 25, so that's the 12% prevalence overall of use of contraband tobacco. And use of menthol is less likely to be purchased on First Nations reserves than other forms of tobacco or than regular cigarettes. As indicated before, there's a large number of people who used flavored tobacco, other flavored tobacco products other than cigarettes. And the use of these flavor products in particular, when we break it down by e-cigarettes, cigars, and other products, was actually much higher among those who were primary menthol users, suggesting that those who were primary menthol users were more likely to go out and seek other sources of flavors. I can show you this data. I have it. Take too many more regression tables, but we did look at a model where we controlled for prior use of flavored products as well as other smoking characteristics. And it was statistically significant, this impact of that, that those who were more regular menthol users were more likely to try flavor after the ban. In terms of quitting, 15% were abstinent at this point, approximately 1 month post-ban. And given the short term, we didn't look at this as an abstinence marker. They hadn't necessarily been, we didn't measure time. They couldn't have possibly been smoke-free for more than 30 days. It's not entirely true, but we didn't really have enough time to measure a long, even a short-term abstinence measure. These are just people who said they were smoke-free at the point of time where we recontacted them. 40%, though, had made a quit attempt since the ban. So that this, of course, is important to note, occurred over January 1st and New Year's Eve's New Year's resolutions. And so we'd expect a fairly high prevalence of quitting. But we can attribute some of this quitting behavior certainly to the ban, that those who are more regular primary users who had made a quit attempt said it was related to the ban versus 22% of those who smoked occasionally. And this also suggests that in jurisdictions that have more primary menthol smokers than Ontario, that this regulation may have an even greater impact than we've seen in Ontario, as it does appear to affect how much menthol you smoke will and taking that away has a bigger impact on outcomes. So just a quick defined with just abstinence at the period, so whether or not they claim to be smoking again, there wasn't enough time to even measure a 1 month smoke-free rate. There were a couple of other responses, including this adding mint manual flavor manually. So here are the ITSA cards, a picture of that were now available at stores and often sold directly with tobacco. And you take the card out of these packages and you could place it in your tobacco pack or in other forms of tobacco other than cigarettes, as well, of course, as other forms of herbal product. There were also a couple of people who said that one of their ways of adapting to the menthol ban was switching to marijuana products, though there were only a couple of people who made that claim. So, in conclusion then, the overall ban, menthol ban, was implemented with minimal political controversy. The industry response suggests that there is maybe some heterogeneity of menthol users, both in terms of their purchasing habits and their response. The early responses of smokers appear to be primarily about trying to quit smoking or using other forms of flavored products. However, there are some indications here that those alternative flavors are not successful long term, and certainly our future predicted behavior of a use of flavors, other types of flavors too, as a substitute long term, decreased over time. So we will be going back to this cohort, and we're looking to survey them again about a year after the implementation of the ban, so that we can do sort of long term quits and be able to look at those. Again, the long-term impact of the menthol regulations. And I have some other data here, but if anyone asks, I can show. But probably no one at this point wants to see too many more tables of numbers. But so thank you for listening. And if you have any questions, I can address them now.
Thanks, Michael. We do have a question about how you defined quit in terms of duration.
So quit was not defined in terms of duration. Again, it may have been the difference between baseline and follow-up could have been as short as 30 days. So we just asked people if they had made a quit attempt and if they were quit at the time of there was no definition of duration at this point in time.
So if you have any questions, please put them in the chat box now. I'm going to go back to the questions that were asked for Dr. Schwartz that haven't been answered yet. So the first is, to clarify, are the replacement brand variants still with a capsule?
No, generally the capsules that had menthol in them were banned, and we didn't see those after the ban. The only capsules we saw after the ban were the aqua filter capsules, and there doesn't seem to be all that much of those around.
And the next question is, have you measured any menthol in cigarettes post-ban?
So we haven't actually done the physical measurements. There is a lab in the States who is undertaking that now, and Health Canada is also likely to be doing some work around that. One of the questions here is whether tobacco companies are using other kinds of coolants that may not be called menthol in order to achieve a similar effect to the menthol. And the question we have is whether those are in the replacements.
Okay, so the next question is, have the ITSA flavor packs made any significant impact on the tobacco market in Canada?
Oh, I don't know the answer to that. Rob, Michael?
This is Rob Nugent. All I can say is that those flavor packs don't fall under reporting regulations, and so we don't have any data on the extent to which those are popular or available. It would be interesting to know, perhaps if there's some follow-ups with menthol smokers, we may be able to find out if people are continuing to use them. It would be an interesting study, that's for certain.
Okay,
And if any of the listeners or participants have any information about the sale of ITSA or even anecdotal evidence about them, we would be delighted to learn about it.
And those that sale was, would have been picked up in our current survey. And there were only a few people who said that they did purchase these cards or similar type of cards or other products that are drops that you can include as well. And so that was noted, but it was, again, it was only a handful of people. So it's not, doesn't appear to be a widespread phenomenon, at least, again, at this short term, at that short term. We'll keep our eye on it when we follow them up in the future.
The next question is for you, Michael. Did that 40% mean people who were quit at follow-up or had made a quit attempt at follow-up?
That was made a quit attempt at follow-up, 15% who were considered themselves to be smoke-free at follow-up.
I have a question. You mentioned that the descriptors for the flavor changed, but did the actual flavor change, or did they just change how they described it?
this is a very difficult question to answer. And from the position of the data where we have it at OTRU, it's really tough to be able to ascertain that. We know what descriptors are, but we don't have that list of ingredients. We can make some guesses. We've seen sort of some packs that very redistributed very quickly with stickers on them, rather than actual change in packages, which suggests that the product itself may not have changed terribly much. But again, I wouldn't be able to answer that question directly or confidently.
If there are no other questions for the two Robs and Michael, I'd like to take the time to thank all of you for speaking today and for the rest of you to participate. We have one more. Is this a comment or a question? In Alberta, there was a significant discrepancy between the ITC 2016 menthol smoker self-reported prevalence and the reported 2016 menthol sales from Health Canada. Any thoughts about that? That was likely for you, Rob Nugent.
Right. Well, thank you, Les, for that question. I didn't see, I'm not aware of the ITC 2016 smoker self-reported prevalence for Alberta. There was a menthol ban in place in Alberta for the entire year of 2016, I believe. And, our data for Alberta shows that menthol cigarettes are not being shipped there. So I'm guessing that the ITC menthol smoker self-reported prevalence, I would have to look at that figure. Les can contact me. He knows how to get in touch with me. He can contact me offline, and we can discuss it.
There's another question, I think also for you, Rob. Did you think that the menthol ban would impact the older population rather than the young people?
Well, I guess it, what we mean by impact. I mean, obviously, there are more youth are disproportionately, when you look at surveys, youth are disproportionately attracted to menthol products. And so the purpose, the objective of the menthol ban federally is to protect youth from inducements to tobacco use. But, of course, youth are always a minority of total smokers, right? Because they're a minority of the population. And so the absolute number of people who will be affected or have to change their smoking behaviors due to a menthol ban will not be youth. They will be adults. But the objective is to protect youth from inducements to tobacco use, which is the objective of the menthol ban. So I guess it's I don't know if I'm hedging my bets with that answer, but I think certainly in terms of absolute numbers, it's adult smokers who will have to make the most adjustment. Where we're hoping to have the biggest impact is with youth uptake. We hope also that it may facilitate quitting and quit attempts, and I think from the data that we've seen today, that might be the case.
And I'd follow up, and we were very interested in trying to look at the impact on youth as well. It's just it's a lot harder to study that kind of event. You really, and the best ways probably that we have are through some of the existing surveys that that we'll start to see numbers from soon. So or in a couple of years perhaps. It's a much more challenging to look at smokers prevented from smoking than looking at a cessation in current smokers.
So we've come to the end of our time together. Thanks again to Rob, Michael, and Robert. Following the webinar, you will be receiving an evaluation survey link. Please fill it out. The slide deck, as well as the audio and video recordings of the webinar, will be made available on the PTCC website. And a link to this page will be included in the email. So thanks again, everyone, and have a great day.